And welcome once again to EW10's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keck, your host. Our guest author is Father Bart Tollison. His book, That Was Father Stew, a memoir of my priestly brother and friend, published by our friends over at Ignatius Press, and of course, naturally available through the EW10 religious catalog, EWTNRC.com for all things Catholic. Welcome, Father Bart, to Bookmark. And people would have seen you on when you were on with our friars on Life on the Rock, talking about this particular topic. Why did you decide to write a book about Father Stu? Why was he so important that they decided to make a movie about him?
So initially, when Mark Wahlberg heard the story from one of Stu's friends, Father Ed Benioff in Los Angeles, he bought the option, and then they tried to get different versions of the script, couldn't get it right. And I had a 3-month sabbatical that my bishop gave me, and I wanted to work on a project, and I thought, it doesn't look like Mark Wahlberg's going to make this movie. So I called up Bill Long, Stu's dad, and I said, what would you think if I started writing some memories and talked to some other people and kind of put together a more significant memoir of his life? And he goes, I think it's a great idea. Right. So I did my first draft and kind of put it on the shelf. And then about 6 months after that, Mark Wahlberg announces he's making Father Stu right before the option on the story ran out.
Okay, right. What prompted him at the last minute, do you know?
I think he found a script finally that Rosie Ross wrote that he really liked. It kind of captured the real Stu.
Okay, so you were in it sort of as an amalgam of multiple people?
I think so. You know, Stu had so many friends, and when Rosie was writing it, she just kind of took personalities and molded them into basically two characters that are in the film that don't really represent anyone particularly.
But used to service the storyline. Now, the foreword of the book is actually written by the Most Reverend George Leo Thomas, Archbishop of Las Vegas, Nevada. Now, you're originally from Texas. You guys were ordained up in Montana. What was the connection with that particular bishop?
Right. So Bishop Thomas was the bishop that decided to ordain Stu and decided to ordain me. So he ordained us together in 2007. And then he was transferred some years later to Las Vegas.
Right. In fact, there's a picture we have up on the screen, but also the front covers, the two of you being ordained together, right? Mm-hmm. Now, he talks about the idea about Stu and you as being, in a sense, a dynamic duo, and that you were Father Stu's best audience. What do you think he meant by that?
You know, I always entertained Stu's ideas and loved to listen to his stories, and would try to give him advice behind the scenes on maybe how people perceived what he was doing and what he was doing. Mm-hmm. He would actually do the same for me as well. So kind of two sides of a coin.
We talk about here a one-of-a-kind man whose life story could be easily transposed into a best-selling novel. It was obviously into a memoir and into a film. What do you mean one-of-a-kind man? What made him unique in your experience with Father Stu?
It's hard to say because he had such a background with his boxing career, his failed acting career, his tough guy, you know, being able to beat people up, and then having this conversion to the Catholic faith that changed his view on life, changed his way of being and living, but still spoke the plain truth. I mean, he just was outspoken about whatever he believed.
Right.
He did it with a sense of humor, too.
Right.
He was really funny.
And then we want to talk about kind of the interesting life he had before, which makes his story so interesting. But he also talks in the beginning, my decision to ordain Stu Long to the priesthood did not come lightly. In fact, he got a letter recommending against Stu's priestly ordination from the seminary officials. Were you in the same case with that, or were you getting the okay and he was getting the maybe not?
We went to two different seminaries. I was getting the okay from my seminary, Stu was getting the, you're too stubborn, we're not sure, you're unpredictable, we're not sure if you're good priestly material. Plus, the disease really kind of put a wall up.
Well, that was the other thing, too. So he was already sick by the time he was in this situation. Had he decided he wanted to become a priest when he was already sick, or did he become sick during that process?
He became sick during the process. He really, his third theology, he had a hip replacement, and that kind of started the trigger of the ongoing slow emergence of the symptoms of the inclusion body myositis.
Right. Explain what that is. That's some sort of like a muscle disease.
It's a cross between ALS and
Lou Gehrig's disease.
The proteins in your nerves and the muscles don't fire. And so you begin to lose function at the extremities, and eventually it works its way into the body, into the head, the heart, and the lungs.
How did you think about it, or how did he think about it, if at all, in relation to, here's a guy who's a strong, strapping man. Out of all the things to happen to him, it's like a muscle disease.
It's ironic, isn't it? God works in mysterious ways.
Right. You said Stu was facing progressive, highly debilitating neurological disease, and he had to, that gave them concern. I saw in Stu a number of, and this is the bishop, priestly qualities that I could not overlook. This is while he was trying to pray about it. He had a prayerful spirit, a love for the underdog, and a deep reverence for the Eucharist and other sacraments. Is that who you saw?
Absolutely, yeah.
What brought his deep reverence for the Eucharist and other sacraments?
I think realizing Jesus was present in all of them, and that's the whole key to everything, Jesus Christ.
Right. Now, the bishop himself said, I begged our Lord and our Lady night and day to show me the path, and he said, the answer to my prayerful pleading was consistent and consoling. Call him to holy orders. There is power in suffering. Is that a voice he heard, or just a feeling he felt like that was the right decision?
I think probably a feeling, but probably an interior voice of Our Lady speaking to the bishop.
Right. And as physicians actually thought he'd only have 2 years to live, and he lived about six.
Yeah.
Six like that. How long could he function as a priest during that period of time?
Until the last week of his life.
Right.
When he basically was in bed, in and out of consciousness.
Is that room 227?
Room 227.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
I was thinking of room 222, the old TV show. Yeah. When I saw that.
But he was in 227.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And you have a chapter about that. You said Hollywood placed Father Stu, not you, but the bishop said, on the worldwide stage, whetting the appetite to learn more about this walking conundrum and his intriguing life story. What kind of reaction have you gotten to people about this particular book, reading about Father Stu? Have you found anybody maybe who feels like, well, maybe I have a vocation and I didn't realize I did, if someone like Stu could change their life so much?
There have been several young men that have written that have said, you know, I'm going to really think seriously about a priestly vocation because I read that book. Mm-hmm. There have been people who have said, I have this disease or this life sentence or whatever, that I have hope when I didn't have hope. Mm-hmm. There have been people that just said, I'm just glad to know more about him past the movie, because the movie didn't really go into the real details of his life or his priesthood much.
So have a lot of people have watched the original movie or the PG version of the movie PG-13, that's out there, from PG-13, for people who are concerned about the heavy language in the beginning of it, and then been drawn to wanting to read the book?
Yes.
So you've seen that from a sales perspective and an interest
level? I don't know about
level?
Sales, but from people shared with me. They were just grateful to have the book after the movie.
Right. Now, you talk about in the beginning here thanking people like Mark Wahlberg, obviously, who started, Rosalind Ross, not Rosalind Moss, but Rosalind Ross.
Right.
Now, she wrote the script.
Writer-director.
Okay. She actually directed
She did.
And then Mel Gibson played his father, who was
Bill Long, yeah.
Now, Bill Long jumps out on the pages as you read it, really the way Stu talked about him, but also the way you talk about him as being such a special person.
He had a tremendous amount of patience when he dealt with Stu, and he was gone for Stu's years when he was growing up. So when Stu got the disease and needed help, Bill decided that he was going to spend time with his son and do what he could to make the most of the rest of his son's life. Mm-hmm. And he sacrificed his life. Sometimes he slept on the floor if Stu had to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. He'd dress him, he'd just sit patiently and watch. The thing that happened is Bill wasn't Catholic. He wasn't even religious at the time.
Okay.
And slowly watching Stu minister to people, be with people, getting to know some other Catholics, it touched Bill's heart to the point the last year of Stu's life. Stu had been praying for it for a long time. Bill and Kathleen, his mom, decided to become Catholic.
Which is why it's so important that we live out our faith, because we don't know who we're impacting, you know, who's watching to see.
And
know.
not just talk about it, but to live it.
Right, to walk the walk. In the beginning, you say, Father Stuart Long, my brother, priest, and friend, died in Helena, Montana in 2014. Summer of 2016, I had a dream about him, and you were backstage in an auditorium. Tell me about the dream and why you decided to mention that right at the beginning.
Well, one of the reasons why is because I thought it was a good way to kind of introduce things, that there's this kind of mystical bend after Stu has died that I feel like we're still connected.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a few dreams with Stu in it. Mm-hmm. And so when Stu shows up, it's like kind of profound. And he shows up in this dream and he's healthy and he's in his clericals and he just says, it's time for you to tell my story. And I just knew there was an audience behind the curtain. I didn't know what that meant other than start preaching about him and telling more stories about him. I didn't know it would lead to the book.
Was that the first time you dreamt about him?
That was the second time, actually. The first time was a year after he died. Actually, the night his mother passed away, or a few nights after that, I dreamed that he came in this car he used to drive as a teenager.
Okay.
And he said, I just came to pick up Ma.
And initially, he walked right by you.
Yeah, he walked right by me.
You were trying to call him, right?
I think he was playing. I was like, Stu, and I thought, well, the dead can't hear the living. And then I kind of turned to walk off, and I felt this kick in my back leg, and I'm on the ground in the long front yard, and I'm looking up, and Stu's laughing at me, saying, you didn't think I could hear you, did you?
Right.
And I thought that was kind of profound, because I think he's like, he can hear, and as all the saints can hear.
Right. He also asked you, right, that once his mother was gone, because he figured he was going to die, but he didn't think she would last that much longer than him, that you should keep an eye on his dad.
Yeah. He asked that. We were talking about his dad, and he basically said, if I wasn't, it wasn't for my dad, I would be dead already. Mm-hmm. My dad saved my life, extended my ministry. So when mom's gone, look out after him.
Right.
I talk to him. Take him to dinner, make him pay the bill,
you know, okay.
So go to the movies. We go to the movies some, so so I've kept up with that relationship, and it's a beautiful thing. Bill's a great guy, and he's been wonderful to be able to have in my life still.
How long did it take you to decide that it wasn't something you ate that caused that dream?
I don't know. I mean, probably a couple days afterwards when I kept thinking about it.
Okay. You say a lot more to his life than the basic facts many people know, and that's what you put in here. Professional boxer. Not long after his conversion entrance into the Catholic Church, he heard a calling to the priesthood. Now, he wasn't a particularly successful boxer, was he?
He was as an amateur. He won Golden Gloves once and runner-up the next year, and he said, the fight that I lost, I didn't really lose. That was Stu. Okay. But once he went professional, he started taking harder punches.
Did he take a dive? Is that what he meant by that?
No. He never took a dive.
He
just got punched in the face and broke his jaw.
And
that started the downtrend of that career.
But so then did he go professional in a period of time? Or was
after Golden Gloves, he broke his jaw as a professional.
Oh, that's how that happened.
Yeah.
You say Stu was a rough guy. He could be hot-headed, impetuous, and crass, but he has surprising and remarkable spiritual insight. What would be an example of his spiritual insight?
You know, he just would tell some sort of cornball joke, and then he would say something like, you know, our Blessed Mother's going to go with you as you do this work today. Mm-hmm. And you'd be like, how did you know about that?
Right.
You know, he's like, because he was observing, listening, and praying.
Right. We talk about he saw the Holy Ones were his friends, and you mentioned Joan of Arc and Padre Pio.
Right.
As two examples of that. He always did say that he would spend a long time in purgatory. Do you think that's true?
I think he did a lot of his purgatory and his suffering while he was still alive, honestly. I do think maybe he spent some time in purgatory after he died. I don't think he went straight to heaven.
Right.
But I also promised him to help him. I mean, that we kind of cut a deal. I talk about it in the book that I'll help you out of purgatory if you'll help me do things as long as I'm here serving as a priest. And we agreed.
Now, have you had, you talk about the idea that a person's desire to ask Stu for his prayers got me thinking. What did it get you thinking?
That maybe it was okay to pray to Stu. Mm-hmm. I mean, at first I was like, I'm against this idea. He's not canonized. I know this guy. He has a lot of bad things that he did. But what are saints?
Right.
They're people that are transformed and redeemed in Jesus Christ, and we're called to eternal life. And the family doesn't break up. Jesus makes that clear in the gospel.
Right.
So if that's the case, then maybe it is all right to ask Stu for help.
Now, were people lined up outside his room because they wanted to see how good he was playing video games or some other
reason? No, that was just me.
Okay.
He wasn't very good either. But no, to get his counsel, to go to a confession, even non-Catholics and even agnostics would go to see him to say, I have a question about this, and Stu would elaborate and talk to him. And he would take his time with every person.
Right. You say, Stu always wanted, and I believe still wants, to be in the mix. Just the thought of it, Stuart Long on the loose in eternity, asking for things to do.
Now, that's a little scary to me, because Stu was always challenging people and would never relent. And I can't imagine that part of his personality necessarily changed if it was holy when he arrives on the Lord's doorstep. And he says, give me some more work to do. I got some stuff I want to do to help people. And I'm sure the Lord is quite pleased to have Stuart Long working for
him. Well, you say,
from
the
other side.
I told some of Father Stu's stories, I guess, at Mass, and some people that previously known him, know nothing about him, actually said that they were inspired by his example. What part of his life did most people tell you they were inspired by?
The fact that he kept his good sense of humor and he continued to serve as a priest despite his debilitation and suffering.
Right. Now, he called you his comrade.
He did? Yeah.
What do you think he meant by that?
I think a brother soldier for Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one that could be trusted.
And he was a practical joker?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. What would be an example of what he might do?
Well, I mean, before he even met me, he got me to ask the Vicar General if we could go to a bar to talk about priesthood, and I thought the bar was a sandwich shop.
Okay.
And, and he thought that was so funny. He hadn't even met me. We just had an email correspondence, so he would just always do little things.
Well, how did you connect on email in the first place?
Well, when I was transferring up to Helena, I knew that he was a seminarian for the Diocese of Helena, got his email address and wrote to him, and he wrote back, and we started emailing back mm-hmm. and forth.
Now, one of the things here I notice, besides post-diagnosis, you talk about, in that section this jumped out at me, that the fact that dealing with Stu via email in the spring of 2007, I received a lot of funny memes and jokes from Stu. He definitely had his sense of humor intact. I love seeing his notes like his Yoda avatar reminding me of Father Benedict Rochelle. But the message came to a halt for a few weeks in March. I wrote to him, but he didn't write back. That's when you became aware that something was up, right?
Something more serious, because Stu always wrote back pretty quickly when mm-hmm. I'd send him an email, and he didn't for several weeks. And the reason was he was away from his computer getting this diagnostic done to definitively diagnose him.
Figure out what was going on, because he knew there was something wrong. Now, did he go to Lourdes?
He did.
Okay.
He did. In fact, before we were ordained, he went and...
Did you go with him? Or?
I did not, no. Okay. No, there was another friend of his from seminary who's now Father Killian McCaffrey, went with him, and I just saw him a few days before he left. He said, I'm going to go to Lourdes and get healed. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, did the Lord tell you something? He goes, I'm going to go into Lourdes. That's what happens. You go to Lourdes and get healed so I can be a priest. Well, I recounted in the book, he did get a healing, but not a physical healing.
Right.
But it was still very powerful.
You know? That's by far and away most of the healings that happen there is a spiritual healing for people,
yeah,
right?
It was an interior healing.
Was he always very positive about things?
For the most part,
yeah.
If he had to be negative, usually for me it was behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. If he had to unload about this or that, he'd say, close the door, and I need to talk to you. And he just said, I can't do this, or this person's driving me crazy, or what do you think about this?
Right.
You know.
Right. Now, he's the one who notified you guys that you were agreed to be ordained and you were getting ordained together?
Yeah. Bishop Thomas had already told me, but he didn't know that I knew, so he was so excited when he got back from Lourdes that the bishop said yes. And that we would be ordained together. And I'd been praying for that, actually.
Right. What is the Anaconda Ace?
He served in Anaconda, Montana.
Oh, okay.
And he brought a levity. There was a new pastor there. And, you know, when a new pastor comes in, there's always kind of a change of a struggle with saying goodbye to the old pastor and welcoming the new. And Stu just brought a levity to that situation that helped smooth the rough edges. And people saw him suffering. And they were like, I got to take this guy seriously.
Right. In chapter 14, have wheelchair, will travel. You talk about, Stu, your masses are powerful, beautiful, and reverent. You still have a voice and energy. The Lord did not give up when he carried the cross, but he needed Simon of Cyrene toward the end.
That was a time when Stu was still celebrating Mass without any aid, and he just couldn't hardly move his hands. And so I kind of came up with the idea or suggested that we train some guys to help him move his hands, to actually touch his hands, and he could coach them about how to do it, and it ended up being very profound. That's how he did Mass for the rest of the time while he was alive.
Who decided to put so many wonderful colored pictures in the book? Was that your idea, Ignatius?
Ignatius, yeah. I said, Stu's story is great told in pictures because you see the real thing. This is a real guy, and these things really happened.
Right.
You see him in pictures, and they thought, we should put some pictures in the book.
Now, you were talking to him, I guess, about saying Mass, etc., but he changed the subject about his parents were both in RCIA and they were becoming Catholic. Was he happy about that?
He was very happy. He'd been praying for that for a long time.
Were you surprised when he told you that?
I was really surprised. I did not see that one coming, but I was grateful. I was thankful. And that was, I think when his parents became Catholic, that was a way Stu could begin to let go and begin to move toward death.
Oh, he felt like maybe some part of his work was done?
Yeah, because that was the last year of his life that happened. So that was significant.
Right. Well, you say, Stu, I said, your dad might not be Catholic yet, but it seems to me he's already a saint of sorts. Where would you have been without him over the last few years? He said, I don't want to think about it, he replied. I'd be nothing without him because I'd be dead.
Yeah. His dad really made his ministry happen. Just being with him all the time, driving him around, changing his clothes, driving, when he got stuck on the toilet the one time, driving 65 miles to go rescue his son. He was just, and he never complained, not very much. And he was just a great man, just a great example, and quiet, and just really good.
Right. Now, you talk about it near the end, the idea of him having mass at was it a nursing home facility or kind
of? Big Sky, where he lived.
Big Sky, okay. Mm-hmm. And people would come and he would still celebrate mass in the wheelchair, right?
Yes,
right.
Yes, yeah. He had been doing mass in the wheelchair for a while, mm-hmm. even before he moved into the care facility.
So at the parish itself,
would do it? Yeah, he actually helped me when I was assigned to a parish that had wheelchair accessibility at the altar.
Okay.
And so he could get down there. He was the first one to do it from a wheelchair. It was profound.
You say, like every priest, Stu was sometimes the victim of backbiting. Because of his past transgressions, he could sense it coming from a mile away. But that's under a chapel called Miracle Confession. How do those go together?
Yeah, well, so Stu had been through a lot of, he'd taken a lot of criticism for his kind of blustery attitude sometimes, and the way he's like, this is right and this is wrong, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And so for me, you know, when I encountered some of that criticism, Stu, he would always challenge me and say, just, you know, this is what it is to be a priest. You just take it. And there was one thing I was dealing with, and I told Stu, and he got really angry, not at me, but at what was going on. Mm-hmm. And that kind of led to, for me, just having a bad night, mm-hmm. and I needed confession. And it just came to me so strongly, go see Stu, which ended up being the last confession that he heard of mine. And I think there was maybe one more after mine. We're not sure about that. But that was one of the last times he heard confession. And he also delivered kind of a prophetic word to me. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of came out of nowhere.
Right. Yeah. Well, you wonder where that came from, right?
Yeah.
What insights were there that maybe weren't there before?
I think just about the fact that in my future, and I think the future of any priest, there's going to be suffering.
Right.
And there's going to be some hard suffering. So get ready and don't get discouraged.
Is there a particular kind of thing or complaint that comes up that you think bothers priests the most?
Oh, it depends on who you are. I mean, you know, you didn't celebrate Mass the right way. You know, Father, this is really important. I need you right now, you know, though you're obviously, you know, in the middle of something else.
12 other things,
but, you know,
right.
people are good and they try to help. You know, I mean, I trust people for the most part, that they have your best interests at heart and they're not trying to sabotage.
Even
people were
Stu
out.
Sometimes
he'd be screaming at people. He says, get out and come back tomorrow. Mm-hmm. No, get out now and come back tomorrow.
Right.
There's a story Father Ed told that once he was trying to wash his face with his hand and some woman came complaining and said her computer was stolen out of her car, her laptop computer, and Stu said, they must have needed it more than you did, so get out. That was his advice. So,
what did they want the priest to do?
Exactly. I don't know. Empathize, probably.
You talk about in chapter 25, the funeral, you say, you when you heard about it, you went to say Mass, right? It was the first time I had ever celebrated a Mass for someone on the actual day of his death. What was that like?
That was surreal, because you have that little part in the Missal that says, or on the day, today, you know, like day of the death, and to actually do a Mass for someone the day they died. Stu was the first one as a priest I did it for.
Right.
And I felt important. And for me, there have been, I think, probably four individuals I've celebrated Mass for now since then, on the day they died.
Oh, really? Okay.
And every single one has had a devotion to Father Stu.
Interesting.
So it's kind of a connection for me that Father Stu's kind of working this, though it's tragic. There's something about God's intervention.
And what is it in their devotion? What's that devotional aspect of Father Stu that they have?
They were praying to him.
They heard his story.
They heard his story and they were inspired, and something about Stu's ministry connected with them, and they felt like they could go to him and trust him.
Now, what you talk about at the time that there, when you did Stu's funeral, or went to the funeral home for the viewing of Stu's body, he was in the casket, vested as a priest, about to say Mass. In his hands were the rosaries he resolutely held on the day that he died. Now, are most priests vested for Mass in their casket?
That's a good question. The ones I've seen have been, but that's...
I don't know. That's why I'm asking.
From the Diocese of Helena, you wear the vestments.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways.
Right. Now, that rosary's funny because Stu, as he was dying, a friend of his let him borrow it, and Stu couldn't talk, but he wouldn't give the rosary back. They were like playing tug-of-war just the day before he died.
That was going with
him. And so that was going to be buried with Stu, that family heirloom from the Simpkins family.
Who was Tim?
Tim Quinn.
Yeah, that's right.
Several Tims. Tim Quinn was a high school friend of Father Stu's. they weren't really close in high school, and so when he heard that Stu was going to be ordained, he thought that's a different Stuart Long.
He came to our ordination
to see if it was the same guy.
Yeah.
And once he saw that it was, he goes, I got to get to know him. Something has happened to this guy I got to find out about.
Right. And Tim had prayed that he would be present at Stu's death, and Tim found it difficult to describe the events that transpired when Stu died. And he said he saw something resembling a sphere of beautiful light rise several different times from Stu's body. The light seemed to be full of love. The first time it arose, it went right through Bill, who was standing at the foot of the bed. Then it disappeared. He goes on, described how the light went right through him, leaving him confident that Christ had come to call his disciple home.
Yeah. Tim and Stu had really gotten to be good friends. Tim was doing a lot of stuff for Stu when Bill couldn't. He got him the van and everything. So Tim had just said, Lord, want to be present when Stu passes. And Teresa Quibido was there and said, Tim, get up here. It's in the middle of the night, but he's going to go. And Tim went up there. Tim Quinn is down to earth as you'll ever meet. He's a Montana guy. He's not a mystical guy.
Right,
and so when he came to me a few days later with tears running down his face and telling me the story, I was like, well, this is not like you.
Right.
And you're not normally like this. So I thought there's some authenticity to this. So let's see where it goes. I mean, I just related it the way he told it to me.
So is this a one-off book for you, or do you like to write, or what?
God only knows. I mean, several people said you need to tell more about what's happened with the legacy of Father Stu, or you need to write about this or that. We'll see what God has in mind.
Okay.
So,
well, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thanks,
Bookmark.
Doug. Good to be with you.
Great to talk to you,
thanks.
Father Bart Tollison, his book. That was Father Stu, a memoir of my priestly brother and friend. And boy, an interesting character, published by Ignatius Press. I'm sure you should check out the PG-13 version of the movie. Look for the book through our EWTN religious catalog, EWTNRC.com, for all things Catholic. I'm Doug Keck. This has been Bookmark. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.